Good afternoon. You're listening to KVMR FM Nevada City, broadcasting on 89.5, serving the foothills of the Sierra, and worldwide on kvmr.org. Stay tuned for Rabble Rousing with host Chamba Lane. Well, we'll begin with an article out of the Sacramento Bee a few days ago. Chemical bans, bills stumble. Heavy lobbying helps counter concerns over possible toxicity. An avalanche of lobbying buried two bills in the Assembly on Monday that sought to ban controversial chemicals from fast food containers, microwave popcorn bags, and baby bottles. The measures were the target of large and well-heeled, quote, working groups of lobbyists employed by chemical companies, manufacturers, and trade associations. Several legislators also objected to what they called heavy-handed efforts to pressure them into voting no. One assemblywoman held up a brochure that had been distributed in her district that depicted a full grocery bag and suggested none of the contents could be sold if those bills passed. Quote, "None of these would be eliminated from the marketplace," she said. "It's an extremely deceptive tactic, and I think we ought not to reward the American Chemical Council by rejecting this bill." But legislators opposed to the measures, while acknowledging the lobbying effort had been annoying, contended that the legislature lacks the expertise to decide what chemicals are or aren't safe. Let's interrupt to look at that. The legislature has decided in its infinite wisdom that they do have the expertise to force you to wear seatbelts and to force you to wear helmets if you're on a motorcycle, and loads of other onerous laws, but in this case, the legislature lacks the expertise to decide what chemicals are or aren't safe. And now get this one. And that the market was a better judge of what are acceptable levels of risk. Now, did you get the logic in that one? The marketplace is supposed to decide if the stuff you're using is toxic or not. And then we have a wonderful quote from Assemblyman Bob Huff, Republican of Diamond Bar. "Just because you have something that can be toxic doesn't make it toxic." Thank you, Representative Bob Huff. Next one's from the American Free Press. Feds run amok. 1 million names on the no-fly list. It's by Paul Craig Roberts. The Bush regime's terrorist protection schemes have reached the height of total incompetence and utter absurdity. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, a private organization that defends the U.S. Constitution that inattentive America neglects, there are now 1 million names on the terrorist watch list. Do you really believe that there are 1 million terrorists and nothing has blown up in the United States since September 11, 2000? Assuming, of course, you believe the government's account of that episode. How can there possibly be 1 million terrorists and Americans still be in one piece? If there were 1 million terrorists, America would be in ruins. According to the Bush regime's line, it only took a handful of terrorists to destroy America's tallest skyscrapers and a section of the Pentagon. What we're witnessing with a 1 million person watch list is bureaucracy run amok. 1 million terrorists make the danger seem overwhelming. Such overwhelming danger rationalizes the aggressive behavior of the bullies and thugs attracted by the power of confiscating your toothpaste and bottled water and rifling your belongings in your luggage, as well as confiscating your laptop, by the way. Show your ID, take off your shoes, your belt, and your jacket. Empty your pockets. Don't complain about being searched without a warrant, or you'll miss your flight. You might be arrested, handcuffed, kicked, and otherwise abused. The fate of many American citizens. The morons, who comprise the U.S. government, call the watch list one of government's most effective tools in the fight against terrorism. The watch list has not apprehended a single terrorist, but thousands of U.S. citizens have been inconvenienced and arrested. The ACLU says that putting a million names on a watch list is a guarantee that the list will do more harm than good by interfering with the travel of innocent people and wasting huge amounts of our limited security resources on bureaucratic wheel spinning. It's worse than that. What the watch list or no-fly list is doing is training Americans to submit to warrantless searches, to abandon their constitutional rights, and to submit to humiliation by thugs and bullies. A Gestapo is being trained to have no qualms about searching and intimidating fellow citizens using any excuse to delay or arrest them. Americans are being taught to use arbitrary power and to submit to arbitrary power. In the false name of safety from terrorists, we are being made the least safe people on earth. I want to piggyback my comment onto that. Several years ago, I was flying foreign, returned, waiting in a long, long line in Miami Airport. And for lack of anything better to do, I started querying my fellow people, fellow Americans, that were waiting in these lengthy lines to go through Homeland Security. And I just asked the innocent question, hey, do you remember when you used to just buy a ticket, go to the airport, and get on an airplane? And the older passengers looked at me and smiled. The younger ones looked at me in bewilderment. They don't remember. They don't know. They have already been trained to accept the absurdity of these lengthy lines and these ridiculous searches. So this guy is right. We are indeed, as a country, being trained to accept this. Next article, also out of the American Free Press. It's by Pat Shannon. Private investigators in Oklahoma City, after a year and a half of sleuthing, have secured proof that the so-called ringleader and mastermind of the 9/11 attacks 7 years ago traveled on a credit card supplied by the U.S. government. National radio talk show host Jack Blood of Texas called it the last nail in the coffin of the 9/11 myth. After 18 months of digging for the facts, Chris Emery and Holland van der Neerwolf and others have exposed a blockbuster. The presence of a Mohammed Atta and five drunken and brawling others in Oklahoma City only days before the 9/11 attack have now been proven with the existence of credit card receipts. Emery and van der Neerwolf announced on Blood's July 18th show that the sequence of numbers on Atta's credit card revealed a unique application found only on U.S. government credit cards. The break came as the team is continuing exhaustive research into the Oklahoma City bombings of 1995. They ran into witness after witness wanting to report that they'd seen Atta and five 9/11 hijackers in Oklahoma City September 6th through 8th, 2001. According to Emery, on September 6th, 2001, at 10 a.m. until noon, Mohammed Atta and four 9/11 hijackers were spotted at, of all places, the Oklahoma City National Memorial Museum by an employee who later told Emery that the five were speaking in a Middle Eastern dialect and they had become boisterous inside the museum. The employee had to tell him to shut up and behave or leave the premises. The five left the building immediately. That museum is the museum for the Oklahoma City bombing. The employee vividly remembers the five because never in the history of the museum have any patrons been asked to contain themselves. It was burned into the brain of the employee, said Emery, and was recalled again a few days later when Atta's cold stare was shown back on national television after the 9/11 attacks. The employee allegedly tried to report the incident to authorities but was ignored. The 9/11 hijackers seen by witnesses with Atta have been revealed, and then it gives five names I'm not going to bother. On September 23, 2001, the BBC in London reported all four of these men by name, along with Atta, as being still alive, placing the FBI's identification of them and 14 others in doubt. Another, now a Saudi Arabian Airlines pilot, was one that the FBI said had piloted American Airlines Flight 11 and crashed it into the World Trade Center. His photograph was released with his denial, attesting to the fact that he was indeed the same person being accused, but that he'd left the U.S. in September of 2000, exactly a year prior to the attacks. He later appeared with his story on various European TV programs, none of which were aired in the U.S. On Friday evening, September 7th, 2001, Atta and the others turned up again at the Oklahoma City bar. The investigators are not ready to divulge the name of the bar at this time, but offered that it is known to be frequented by police, spooks, and questionable characters. The group returned to the same bar the next night. Without a Quran or prayer rug in sight, the five were drinking beer and hard liquor, dancing, and eventually picking a fight with two local patrons. The witnesses said this high-profile, anti-Islamic fundamentalist behavior is not easy to forget. Atta, according to witnesses, was the ringleader and the one picking the fight, while his four cohorts stood ready to jump into the fray. In recent weeks, Emery and a team were able to obtain the bar's credit card receipts from that night and have spent most of the last 18 months attempting to trace the card numbers and the authorization of the cards themselves, which is a time-consuming and painstaking task. Amazingly, One card number used by Ada and the crew had been expired a full 6 months before the September 7th and 8th dates the card was used and approved at this Oklahoma City establishment. The club's management said that they had never seen such a thing happen ever before, and apparently Ada had secured some kind of preclearance beforehand. The transaction was approved without delay. A fifth hijacker was back in the same bar on the weekend following the 9/11 attacks. He ordered DeWar's Scotch whiskey, the same brand of liquor as had Ata. The transaction was paid with another U.S. government credit card, also 6 months expired. Again, the purchase was approved without a hitch. Pat Shannon writing in the American Free Press. My commentary for today, August 20th. Rabble-rousing shows are now archived and can be heard at your convenience 24/7. Tell your friends to go to KVMR homepage, kvmr.org. Then in the right-hand column, click on Program Schedule. Then click on the program page for Rabble-rousing, and past shows will be listed there. Well, while you were sleeping, I finally figured out the Bush administration plan for rescuing our plummeting economy. Resurrect the Cold War. It's long been known that the American economy only thrives during wartime. Now, I don't mean actually fighting a war. Our misadventures in Vietnam, and now in Iraq and Afghanistan, make more or less proves that we're hopelessly out of date at actually fighting a modern imperialistic war against a people who don't want us there. But preparing for war. Boy, oh boy, are we good at that. Our politicians and industrial leaders have no idea how to run a successful country during times of peace, so they don't even try. But give us a non-shooting war to prepare for, and our military-industrial complex thrives. And when they thrive, there actually is a trickle-down effect, as the rich and greedy invest in their stock market gambles, the war factories hum, the cash registers ring, and America smiles. If you look at the recent maneuvering of the neocons running our country into the ground, the conclusion is unmistakable. They're hell-bent on antagonizing Russia and resurrecting the Cold War. How else can you explain our convincing Poland and the Czech Republic, countries on Russia's borders, to install missiles on their territory? The cover story, that these missiles are to provide defense, is so thin I'm surprised anyone has the nerve to utter it publicly. And what is that absurd excuse? The missile shield is to protect the Poles and Czechs against an attack by, get this, Iran. Right. The bad old Iranians may launch their missiles against Poland and the Czech Republic. We tried the same gambit with Turkey, but the Turks were too smart to fall for it. The Poles? Not so smart. Then there's our gambit of installing a seeming puppet in Georgia so we can build an oil pipeline through his country. And if you noticed, that hasn't panned out too well either. Our boy got greedy, obviously with our tacit approval, and overstepped his reach, and you can see the result of that gambit. Just like Saddam invaded Kuwait, also with our tacit approval, and look what happened to him. But Shashkashvili didn't study his history and invaded South Ossetia, and whoops, now he's lost not only that province, but another one as well. His country's in a shambles, the Russians occupying the rest of territories he thought were his, and his government's on the edge of collapse. And the only thing of importance to us is that our sacred pipeline is in jeopardy. The guy obviously didn't read his history. Back in 1956, we encouraged the Hungarians to revolt against their Russian masters, promising to support them, then sat on our hands while the Russians brought in their tanks and crushed the revolution. More recently, after the first Iraq War, we encouraged the Shiites in southern Iraq to rebel against Saddam Hussein, and again promising to back them, then sat on our hands again and said, tisk, tisk, as Saddam crushed the Shiites. Why don't world leaders get it? The Americans promise to support revolutions, but the promises turn out to be worth exactly as much as our promises to the American Indians before we stole all their lands. Theodore Roosevelt said, speak softly and carry a big stick. That philosophy has been replaced by speak loudly and often and then do nothing. Next item. As bleak as things look in some parts of the world, there are strong signs of progress in others. While the American imperialists are mired in the Middle East, in their backyard, the populist revolution in Latin America continues. Paraguay, which suffered under a right-wing dictator for decades, just inaugurated a populist ex-priest as president. And after celebrating with fellow populist Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, the new president, named Lugo, appointed an indigenous woman to a cabinet post. And to think, less than a century ago, America sent its Marines into Latin America to keep United Fruit Company in power. Ah, the Marines. Over hill, over dale, over land, over sea, they will fight for the right of imperialist bankers to exploit third world peoples for bananas or oil. Doesn't seem to matter what the excuse is. The armies of the bankers are ever ready to rock and roll. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And yet, as the Marines are busily killing and getting killed in the Middle East, Latin America struggles toward a better life for its peoples. I hope they appreciate their good fortune and thank the Iraqis. Okay, let's lighten up a bit. An award should go to the Virgin Islands desk attendant in Sydney some months ago for being smart and funny while making her point when confronted with a passenger who probably deserved to fly as cargo. A crowded Virgin flight was canceled after all the Virgin 767s had been withdrawn from service. A single attendant was rebooking a long line of inconvenienced travelers. Suddenly, an angry passenger pushed his way to the desk. He slapped his ticket down on the counter and said, "I have to be on this flight, and it has to be first class." The attendant replied, "I'm sorry, sir. I'll be happy to try and help you, but I've got to help these people first, and I'm sure we'll be able to work something out." The passenger was unimpressed. He asked loudly so that passengers behind him could hear, "Do you have any idea who I am?" Without hesitating, the attendant smiled and grabbed her public address microphone. "May I have your attention, please? May I have your attention, please?" Her voice heard clearly throughout the terminal. "We have a passenger here at Desk 14 who does not know who he is. If anyone can help him find his identity, please come to Desk 14. With the folks behind him in line laughing hysterically, the man glared at the Virgin attendant, gritted his teeth, and said, "F you." This is the best part. Without flinching, she smiled and said, "I'm sorry, sir, but you'll have to get in line for that, too." It is 12:25. The radio station is KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The show is Rabble Rousing. This one's by Mike Whitney, writing in Smoking Chimp. He calls it Putin's Winning Hand. There are no military installations in the city of Tishinvili. In fact, there are no military targets at all. It's an industrial center consisting of lumber mills, manufacturing plants, and residential areas. It's also the home to 30,000 South Ossetians. When Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili ordered the city to be bombed by warplanes and shelled by heavy artillery last Thursday, he knew that he would be killing hundreds of civilians in their homes and neighborhoods. But he ordered the bombing anyway. There was no Battle of Tishinvili. That's another fiction. A battle implies that there's an opposing force that is resisting or fighting back. That's not the case here. The Georgian army entered the city unopposed. After all, how can unarmed civilians stop armed units? Most of the townspeople had already fled across the border into Russia or hid in their basements, while the tanks and armored vehicles rumbled by, firing at anything that moved. What took place in South Ossetia last Thursday was not an invasion or a siege. It was a massacre. The people had no way to defend themselves against a fully equipped modern army. It was a war crime. In less than 24 hours, the Russian army was deployed to the war zone, where it chased the Georgian army away without a fight. Journalist Michael Binion put it like this, quote, "The attack was short, sharp, and deadly, enough to send the Georgians fleeing in humiliating panic," close quote. Indeed, the Georgians left in such a haste that many of their weapons were left behind. It was a complete rout, another black eye for the U.S. and Israeli advisors, who trained the clatter of thugs they call the Georgian army. Soon, vendors on the streets of Tishinvili will be hawking weapons that were left behind. In a mocking sign, "Georgia Army M16, never used, dropped once." By the time the army was driven out, the downtown area was engulfed in flames, and the bodies of those who had been killed by sniper fire were strewn along the streets and sidewalks. Many people who stayed behind were simply too old or infirm to leave. Instead, they huddled in their basements, waiting for the shelling to stop. It was a bloodbath. The city's only hospital was deliberately targeted and destroyed, another war crime. By day's end, over 2,000 people were killed in an operation that was clearly engineered with the assistance of the Bush White House. Bush regards Saakashvili as his main client in the region. They're friends. He's America's cat's paw in the Caucasus. Saakashvili's assignment is to try and get Putin to overreact militarily and demonstrate to European allies that Russia still poses a threat to their national security. Fortunately, many Europeans see through the ruse and know that the trouble originates in Washington. For the most part, Americans are still in the dark about what really happened last weekend. There's a great video circulating on the internet by a Russian citizen who's been living in the USA for the past 10 years. He sums up the role of the U.S. media with great precision. He says, quote, "The Western media, especially CNN, is feeding you complete horse crap. Russia did not invade Georgia first." Close quote. The coverage of the Western media has been abysmal. Nearly every article and TV news segment begins with accusations of Russian aggression, concealing the fact that the Georgian army bombed and invaded the capital of South Ossetia one full day before the first Russian tank even crossed the border. By the time the Russians arrived, the city was already in a shambles and thousands were dead. These facts are not in dispute by those who followed the developments as they took place. Now the media is revising the facts to manage public perceptions, just as they did with the fictional weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Many people think that the media learned its lesson after they were exposed for using bogus information in the lead-up to the war in Iraq. But this is not true. The corporate media, especially Fox News, CNN, and PBS, the smug, liberal-sounding channel, continue to operate like the propaganda arm of the Pentagon. It's disgraceful. In a 2006 referendum, 99% of South Ossetians said they supported independence from Georgia. The voter turnout was 95%, and the balloting was monitored by 34 international observers from the West. No one has challenged the results. The province has been under the protection of Russia and Georgian peacekeepers since 1992, and has been a de facto independent state ever since. If Putin applied the same standards as Bush did in Kosovo, he would unilaterally declare South Ossetia independent from Georgia and then thumb his nose at the United Nations. Sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. But Putin and newly elected Russian President Dmitry Medvedev have taken a conciliatory attitude toward the international community and tried to resolve the issues through diplomatic channels. So far, they've conducted themselves with restraint and avoided any confrontation. Still, Russia operation in South Ossetia has ignited a firestorm in the U.S. political establishment, and Democrats and Republicans alike are demanding that Russia be, quote, taught a lesson. Condoleezza Rice flew to Tbilisi on Friday and ordered Russian combat troops to withdraw from Georgia immediately. Saakashvili topped off Rice's comments by saying that the Russian troops were cold-blooded killers and barbarians. So much for reconciliation. Saakashvili's hyperbolic rhetoric was followed by a surprise announcement from Poland that they'd approved Bush's plans for deploying the missile defense shield in Eastern Europe. The system is supposed to defend Europe from the possibility of attacks from so-called rogue states like Iran, but the Kremlin knows that it is intended to neutralize their nuclear arsenal. Political analyst William Engel explains the importance of the proposed system in his recent article, Missile Defense. Washington and Poland just moved the world closer to war. The signing now ensures an escalation of tension between Russia and NATO and a new Cold War arms race in full force. It is important for readers to understand the ability of one of two opposing sides to put anti-missile missiles to within 90 miles of the territory of the other. In even a primitive first-generation anti-missile missile array, gives that side virtual victory in a nuclear balance of power and forces the other to consider unconditional surrender or to preemptively react by launching its nuclear strike before 2012. The new shield will be integrated into the larger U.S. nuclear weapons system, placing the world's most lethal weapons just a few hundred miles from Russia's capital. It's a clear threat to Russia's national security, and it must be opposed at all cost. It is no different from nuclear weapons in Cuba. The timing of the announcement is particularly troubling as it only adds to the tension between the two superpowers. President Medvedev made this statement after hearing of Poland's decision. Quote, "This decision clearly demonstrates everything we have said recently. The deployment of new anti-missile forces in Europe is aimed at the Russian Federation." Close quote. It was President Ronald Reagan, the darling of the neoconservatives, who decided to remove short-range nuclear weapons from the European theater. Now, ironically, it is his ideological heir, George W. Bush, who's on track to restart the Cold War by putting a high-tech nuclear system on Russia's perimeter. The younger Bush has already broken his father's commitment to Mikhail Gorbachev to never expand NATO beyond Germany. Presently, Bush is pushing to gain NATO membership for two former Soviet states, Ukraine and Georgia. If they are approved, then any future dispute with Russia will pit the United States and Europe against Moscow. It's no wonder Putin is trying to derail the process. The Bush administration has been planning for a confrontation with Russia for more than a year. In fact, RawStory.com reported on operations that were conducted by the military on July 14th of this year, which were probably a dress rehearsal for the current conflict. According to Raw Story, U.S. troops on Monday, July 14th, began military exercises near the Russian border in ex-Soviet Ukraine and were poised to launch them in Georgia, amid tense relations between Moscow and Washington. A ceremony inaugurating the Seabreeze 2008 NATO exercise was held off Ukraine's Black Sea coast against anti-NATO protests and hostile reactions from officials in Russia. Seabreeze 2008 includes forces from Armenia, Azerbaijan, Belgium, Britain, Canada, Denmark, France, Georgia, Germany, Greece, Latvia, Macedonia, and Turkey. The U.S.-Georgian joint exercise will be held at the Vaziani military base, less than 60 miles from the Russian border, with a total of 1,650 servicemen taking part. So it appears the Bush administration, working in conjunction with the Pentagon, did have contingency plans for dealing with a flare-up with Georgia. The real question is whether or not they plan to initiate those hostilities to advance their own regional agenda. No one knows for sure. Now that Georgia's American-trained army has been humiliated in front of the world, Bush is trying desperately to save face by demanding that Russia allow the U.S. Air Force to deliver humanitarian aid via C-17 military aircraft to the tens of thousands of Georgians who were displaced in the fighting. It's worth noting that as yet, Bush has never delivered as much as a bag of rice to the 2 million Iraqi refugees living in Jordan and Syria due to his war in Iraq. Bush's magnanimity is not only suspect, it also creates real problems for Putin, who will have to decide whether the offer is sincere or just a ploy to open up the ports and airfields so that more weaponry and ordnance can be delivered. As Barry Gray suggests in his article, Bush dispatched U.S. military forces to Georgia, the humanitarian operation could be a scam. This is a formula for an injection of U.S. military and naval forces into Georgia of an indeterminate scope and duration. It will certainly involve the presence of hundreds, if not thousands, of uniformed U.S. military personnel on the ground and a substantial number of warships in the region. The U.S. is introducing this military force into a situation that remains highly unstable and combustible, raising the possibility of a direct military clash between the United States and Russia. Gray is right. But what choice does Putin have? His task is to avoid military confrontation with the United States while demonstrating to his European partners that their future lies with Russia, not America. That's the real goal. To achieve that, he needs to expose Bush as reckless, petulant, and incapable of being a responsible steward of the global system. Maybe Putin will have to back down at some point and swallow his pride. It makes no difference. What matters is the end game. Showing that Russia is strong and dependable and will provide its European allies with oil and natural gas in a businesslike manner. That's the winning hand. Meanwhile, the United States will be forced to take a long overdue look in the mirror and revisit its strategy for perennial war. Unfortunately, once the Atlantic Alliance is shattered, America's lifeline to the world is kaput. My comment. That's going to be a very interesting situation if, in fact, there are U.S. military personnel in Georgia, whether under whatever guise, because, of course, it's very easy for someone to create an incident. Then you have American troops fighting Russian troops on Georgian soil, and you have the beginning of a very nasty situation. Well, I found this one interesting. Deconstructing the Democratic Party's Platform. It's by Case Wagenvoord, writing at SmirkingChimp.com. The Democratic faction of America's lone political party has established a draft of its party platform And yes, it is official. America is now a one-party nation. It's right there on page 3 of the preamble to the platform. Quote, "There can be no Republican or Democratic ideas, only policies that are smart and right and fair and good for America, and those that aren't." Close quote. For lack of a better name, let's call our lone party the Corporatist Party of America, or CPA. Like all one-party oligarchies, the CPA represents a political spectrum. At one end of the spectrum sits the hard right of the Democratic Leadership Council, and at the other end sits the rabid neocon right. The Democratic Leadership Council, or DCL, is more inclined to mouth populist platitudes than the neocons, but they're both cut from the same cloth, even if the neocons are the more sociopathic of the two. This explains why presidential campaigns are so boring. How can there be a clash of principles if everyone agrees on the basics? The platform itself is a study of the excruciating tension that exists between platitudes and reality. The platitudes are renewing the American dream, affordable health care, good jobs with good pay, opportunity for women, a world-class education for every child, investing in manufacturing and our manufacturing communities, restoring fairness to our tax code, reforming financial regulation and corporate governance, smart, strong, and fair trade policies, fiscal responsibility. The reality is, our oligarchs need their empire, so we can't afford any of the above. America is not addicted to oil. Instead, we have an oligarchy that is addicted to empire because they're convinced that a war economy is the only thing that's keeping the Great Depression at bay, and should we dismantle our military machinery, the country would slide into economic ruin, which we are anyway, but who's paying attention? To all appearances, we're the dumbest goddamn empire ever to stumble down the historical pike. The sole raison d'etre of an empire is to create a revenue stream, either through taxes, tribute, or a flow of raw materials back to the mother country. Our empire is at a lost leader, awash in a sea of red ink. With a national debt at $9.6 trillion, it looks as if we're missing the imperial boat here. However, we forget that we are a nation of innovators who have redefined the meaning of empire for the sole function of the American empire is to transform public funds into the private pockets of our oligarchs. As far as the CPA is concerned, our economy is a robust one. It can withstand a subprime debacle, skyrocketing oil and commodity prices, massive foreclosures, and the impoverishment of its middle class. The one thing it could never withstand is an outbreak of peace. This is why 9/11 was such a godsend for the CPA, and why the Georgian invasion of South Ossetia is the frosting on the cake. Our oligarchs need a constant influx of new threats to justify our annual trillion-dollar defense budget. The Democratic faction is singing their song set to the tune of military Keynesianism. The faction is four square behind the messianic spreading of liberal democracy to the world. Note the use of liberal democracy as opposed to social democracy, which is evil in the eyes of the CPA. Liberal democracy is a code for the Washington Consensus, which has left as much destruction in its path as the Christian missionaries did when they swept through Latin America in the 16th century. Empire building is a form of dementia that invariably ends with the destruction of the imperial builder, not from the onslaught of barbarians from without, but from the barbarians within. An example of our dementia is our global war on terror, also known as the eternal war of the empty policy. It posits an ultimate military victory over the terrorists. Recently, the RAND Corporation, a government-sponsored think tank, issued a report that suggested that the military approach was a really dumb way to fight terrorism. First of all, it doesn't do the job. But what's even worse, according to the think tank, is that the use of substantial U.S. military power against terror groups also runs a significant risk of turning the local population against the government by killing citizens. Duh! You don't win hearts and minds by bombing a nation's wedding parties. Praise God the Democrats are not flinching in the face of this revelation. Their platform, on page 24, calls for sending two additional combat brigades to Afghanistan to continue winning their hearts and minds. And we're going to carry the fight to Al-Qaeda by forming a new partnership with Pakistan, similar to the partnership that exists between a python and its prey. Our oligarchs can sleep peacefully tonight. The Democrats are telling us that, quote, to renew America's leadership in the world, we must revitalize our military. That's music to an oligarch's ears. And progressives still wait around for the Democrats to deliver. Al Fromm, a founder of the Democratic Leadership Council, summed it up nicely when he said, the anti-war people cannot define the Democratic Party. Of course they can't. Peace might break out. The plain simple truth is that the core nugget around which progressives of all stripes must rally is that we must dismantle our empire and redirect its resources to healing America. We won't get any help from the Democrats on this. They're in the enemy camp. So we may have to start going our own way and begin the pain-in-the-butt work of building a movement. It's doubtful any of us will live to see the results, but with luck and hard work, perhaps our children and grandchildren will. Kees Wagenvoord, writing in SmirkingChimp.com. This is Peter Cohan. He teaches management at Babson College and edits the Cohan Letter. Politics aside, the main message is, one, banks are failing, and two, the FDIC will run out of money. And the answer is, let's print more money. The Washington Post reports that the number of bank failures has been surprisingly low. But the crunch count is likely to grow as the problem bank list triples from 90 to 300 over the next 3 years. Meanwhile, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, could run out of money to pay off depositors of future failed banks unless it raises its deposit insurance rates from the current 5.4 cents per $100 deposits. But the most interesting question is whether the White House is propping up banks that should fail so that it can push the biggest part of the cleanup into the lap of the next president. It is certainly bringing out all the biggest economic guns to delay the inevitable reckoning from the $8 trillion credit collapse. It spent $29 billion bailing out Bear Stearns, sent $160 billion worth of checks to taxpayers, cut interest rates from 5.25% to 2%, and seems belatedly to be enforcing regulations against manipulation of oil trading. The Post quotes industry experts who think that the FDIC is propping up many banks. For instance, Bert Ely of Ely & Company, a banking consulting firm in Alexandria, Virginia, told the Washington Post, quote, they're dragging their feet and forcing these banks to reserve realistically. Some of these banks could have been closed two or three quarters earlier. And Ken Thomas, a lecturer in finance at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, told the Post that FDIC's foot-dragging would only cost taxpayers more in the long run. Read after the election. Thomas said, in some of these cases, I believe regulators should act sooner than later to prevent future losses to the fund. Even the banks are facing hard times these days, and some have to close up shop entirely. Note, when a financial institution is closed, no advance notice is given to the public. Some of the most recently failed high-profile banks, as reported by the FDIC, and they give a whole list of banks. There's one in Newport Beach, California, which was closed by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Subsequently, the Federal Deposit Insurance Company was named receiver. In the past year, the same thing happened with a bank in Nevada, a bank in Arizona, bank in Pasadena, California, bank in NA. I'm not sure where NA is. Another one in NA. In Minnesota, Arkansas, Missouri, another bank in Missouri, and Ohio, and also one in Georgia. With record bank losses possible this year, the FDIC's fund could drain to a dangerous low level. The Post reports that the failures so far this year will drain the FDIC's insurance fund by an estimated $9.2 billion. And this year's losses could hit the inflation-adjusted record of $12.8 billion set in 88. The drain on the FDIC fund could happen fast. Losses so far this year will cut 17% from its record high balance. That could drop the fund below its minimal requirements of all U.S. insured deposits. The reason? The number of problem banks is liable to rise from 90 to 300 in the next 3 years, according to Gerald Cassidy, an analyst with RBC Capital Markets. The Post reports that historically, regulators end up closing about 13% of the institutions on the problem bank list. It would not surprise me if that spurt in activity begins after the November elections. My comment. So what does all this mean? As long as FDIC insures your deposits, your money is safe even if your bank fails. But if FDIC goes under, you may wish you'd kept your money under your mattress. On the other hand, since the Fed is printing money out of thin air, thereby depreciating its value, you might want to consider investing in something more real than paper dollars. Ah, so many articles, so little time. Okay, let's try this one. Adventures in the Poison Factory by Chris Floyd. It was in opednews.com. Cheney and the gang have been up to their old Hitlerian, let's fake it, causes belly tricks in regards to a war in Iran, while the American corporate media continues to cover up, eagerly, slavishly, what Glenn Greenwald rightly calls one of the most important and astounding stories of our time, how the Bush administration completely concocted false evidence pointing to Saddam Hussein involvement in the post-9/11 anthrax terrorism, then fed those lies to the aforementioned eager, slavish, the corporate media hacks at ABC. As Greenwald notes, the hacks know exactly who fed them these lies, which were instrumental in fomenting war fever for the act of aggression against Iraq. But they refuse to give up these conniving, traitorous wretches. Still think you're living in a free country with a free press? We've said it before and we'll say it again. At this point, anyone in public office who acknowledges the Bush faction as being in any way a legitimate government instead of a pack of criminals in need of immediate and relentless prosecution is in fact complicit in the faction's crimes. As I wrote here a while back, and do I have these? I'm sorry, I don't have the author of this. Yes, I do. No. Chris Floyd. As I wrote here a while back, tomorrow is here, the game's over, the crisis is past, and the patient is dead. Whatever dream you had about what America is, it isn't that anymore. It's gone. And not just in some abstract sense, some metaphorical or mythological sense, but down in the nitty-gritty, in the concrete realities of institutional structure and legal framework of policy and process, even down to the physical nature of the landscape and the way that people live. The republic you wanted, and at one time might have had the power to take back, is finished. You no longer have the power to keep it. It's not there. It was kidnapped in December 2000, raped by the prime and ready exploiters of 9/11, whored by the war pimps of the 2003 aggression, gut-knifed by the corruptors of the 2004 vote, and raped again by its rescuers after the 2006 election. Beaten, abused, diseased, and abandoned, it finally died. We're living in its grave. How does it become a man to behave towards this American government today? I answer that he cannot, without disgrace, be associated with it. That was said by Thoreau. The time has passed for ordinary political opposition within the system. The system itself has been perverted and converted into something else. It is now impossible to work within the system, in the old understanding of that term, because that old system is gone. To work within the current system is to collaborate with evil, to give it legitimacy. Thoreau's answer should be taken up by every person in public life, beginning with the senators and representatives in Congress, and radiating outward to all other elected officials in the 50 states, and to civil servants and other government employees, law enforcement agencies, judges, universities, contractors, banks, and on and on, throughout the vast, intricate web that binds the lives of so many people directly to the federal government. There should be non-compliance, non-recognition of this illegitimate authority, disassociation from taking part in its workings. But we must also recognize that the kind of civil disobedience that Thoreau preached and practiced is immensely more difficult today because the power of the state is so much greater, far more pervasive, more invasive, and much more implacable, more inhumane. No one would have dared put Thoreau in indefinite detention without charges or torture him, or delegate some underling in intelligence apparatus, which didn't even exist then, to kill him as a suspected terrorist. Of course, there were many egregious suspensions of constitutional liberties and draconian measures during the Civil War, but these occasioned fierce fights in Congress, investigations, lawsuits, and outraged protests on the street. the worst by far in American history, dwarfing the urban riots and war protests of the 60s. But only the most ignorant fool or devious liar could compare these short-lived, ad hoc, inconsistently applied, frequently reversed, and much disputed depredations carried out in the midst of a massive insurrection by full-fledged armies on American soil with today's thoroughgoing, systematic creation of an authoritarian state on the basis of a zealous ideology of an unrestricted, unitary executive operating in a nebulous, self-declared state of war that we're told will last for generations. Neither Thoreau nor any northern opponent of the Civil War confronted anything like this. In fact, neither did the insurrectionists of the South, who were treated as lawful prisoners of war when captured, or often simply allowed to return to their homes on parole in exchange for a simple statement that they would fight no more. No Southerner was ever subjected to indefinite detention. None were tortured. None were liquidated by secret agents. The technology available to the government today amplifies the scope of oppression immeasurably, both in the pinpoint, surreptitious targeting of individuals and in larger scale operations. In a land crawling with armed and armored SWAT teams, with operatives from innumerable federal agencies packing heat and happy to use it, a land where more than 2 million people languish in prison, many of them captives of an endless war on drugs, that has done nothing to curb substance abuse, but has greatly augmented the power of the state and the criminal gangs whose laundered money enriches establishment elites. A land where almost every transaction is wired up to some national grid, where national ID cards are now being imposed. A land where you literally cannot exist without placing your liberty, your privacy, your very life, at the mercy of a government apparatus besotted with violence, coercion, and intrusion. There is no place left for the kind of action that Thoreau advocated. His way, and that of Gandhi and King, who took so much from him, envisions a state opponent which one could hope to shame into honorable action by the superior moral force of principled civil disobedience. But the very hallmark of the present regime is its shamelessness, its utter lack of any sense of honor or principle, its bestial addiction to raw power. It's pointless and contraproductive to simply throw yourself under the wheels of such a monstrous machine in futile spasms of rage and despair. The machine doesn't care. It will gladly chew up your life and move on. For the action of the ordinary individual to have an effect, it must be amplified by a larger social movement. And it is difficult to imagine such a movement arising in America today, in a society atomized by the engines of profiteering, its communities gutted or abandoned by elites seeking greener pastures and cheaper labor. Elsewhere, its citizens isolated from one another, locked in their own bubble of electronic diversion and their own struggles to keep their jobs, unprotected by unions, subject to the arbitrary whim of local bosses or faceless corporate masters or predatory hedge funds, etc. They hang on to their health insurance if they've got it and stay out of the hell created by the bipartisan bankruptcy bill for the benefit of the credit card companies. And despite the deep unpopularity of the regime, there is still a widespread reluctance to recognize its true nature and what it will require to restore our constitutional republic. And truth to tell, there are a great many people uninterested in doing so. As long as the diversions keep pouring through the latest gadgetry, the monthly paycheck manages to cover the bills, and their own bodies are not subject to the tyrant's evil, many people are happy to accept the authoritarian system. This is not unique to Americans, of course. It's a constant in human history. But even where there is an interest in discerning the reality of our times and a yearning for change, again, there's no broad movement to leverage an individual's dissent into a form large enough to thwart the tyrannical machine. And there's no American Sakharov on the horizon, someone to arise from the very center of the machine to denounce its workings and call for genuine liberty, genuine democracy, genuine economic and social justice. So whatever we can do, we must do for ourselves. If we have no power or influence, if we cannot take large actions, then we must take small ones. Every word or action raised against the overthrow of the republic will find an echo somewhere, from one person to another, to the next, each isolated individual voice slowly finding its way into a swelling chorus of dissent. It might be too late. It might not work. But failure and much more horror is guaranteed if we don't even try. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn once wrote, in a context that is growing less dissimilar all the time. It is impossible that even evil should not come into the world, but take care that it does not enter through you. What is the price current of an honest man and patriot today? They hesitate and they regret and sometimes they petition, but they do nothing in earnest with effect. They will wait, well-disposed, for others to remedy the evil that they may no longer have it to regret. That was also Thoreau. All right. We're out of time. Thanks for listening. Those regular listeners, long-time listeners, will know that this show is actually sponsored by the CIA and the FBI, and they have ordered me to go to Burning Man next week. It's a tough job, but somebody has to do it. So I'll be gone next week, but I think we're going to coerce John Fletcher into being the host of next week's show. Then I will be back in 2 weeks, and we'll do our annual Burning Man show where we try to recover from Burning Man on air. So those of you that are going to Burning Man, try and pay enough attention so that in 2 weeks you can phone in with your stories.